Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about quite an unknown, an obscure, an overlooked chapter in British imperial history, and that was Britain's really conquest and invasion of South Vietnam at the end of the Second World War, and the decision of the occupying forces to reinstate the French colonists who had been sidelined by the Japanese during the Second World War. At the end of the war, Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist Chinese Kuomintang armies had taken the north of Vietnam and the capital Hanoi. The British, since 1943 onwards, had been considering what to do about the rest of Southeast Asia. They obviously had every intention of recapturing Burma, Malaya and Singapore. But the rest of Southeast Asia, Thailand and Indochina particularly, there was a big question mark over their future. The French had been largely expelled from Indochina. Those French colonists who stayed behind were solidly behind the Vichy regime and had reached an accommodation with the Japanese, not a particularly pleasant one for the French, but an accommodation nonetheless. And the British believed that it was probably important to secure Indochina at least. The consequences of not doing that might be serious for the remainder of the British Empire in Asia. You may find that that Indochina came under the sway of Thailand, who had been a Japanese ally and proxy during the war and was certainly considered to be at least a highly suspicious power, or it might come under the control of whatever government wound up running China, either nationalist or communist. Even worse, you might find that a independent and vigorously nationalistic Vietnam would send out all sorts of unpleasant signals to the rest of colonised Asia that the British ideally wouldn't want to allow. And so controlling it, even if you do wind up giving back to France, it's still important to control the area to make sure that an unfriendly or unwanted regime doesn't establish itself. There, of course, was that old question of obligation as well. The Free French had been allies of the British during the war, and to help them re-establish their colonies was seen by Churchill as really the right thing to do, from his own particular imperialist logic. Roosevelt, on the other hand, disagreed. Roosevelt thought that the Indochina should come under a United Nations protectorate, and Roosevelt particularly loathed de Gaulle, and Roosevelt had suspicions that de Gaulle might become a dictatorial figure in post-war France. Roosevelt had little time for the Free French and did not really factor them into the new world order that he saw emerging after the war, this four-power world of America, the Soviet Union, Britain, and hopefully China. The French would be hopefully diminished sufficiently and lose a sufficient amount of their colonies to no longer be a world power. The general who re-established French control of Indochina was General Douglas Gracie, who was the commander of the 20th Indian Division, and who marched into Indochina in September 1945. And this was on the orders of Lord Louis Mountbatten, head of the Southeast Asia Command. The Gracie, however, when he is in Indochina, acts almost as a kind of an independent imperial viceroy. He uses not only the Indian army, but the surrendered Japanese forces to put down the beginnings of a nationalist uprising by Ho Chi Minh. So the Vietnam that Gracie finds is a very complex affair. Not only had it been under French rule, conquered in a piecemeal fashion, in a patchwork way, and local lords and leaders were allowed some degree of limited sovereignty, the country is geographically divided, really, into a kind of a cultivated and colonised Cochin China, the southern part of Vietnam, where plantations were established and estates for coffee and rubber were set up, and the wilder north and east, which was far less cultivated and settled, dense forests and mountains, meant that the French were happy to give more authority to the native rulers. The French had used quite a great deal of brutality and violence during the interwar years to put down peasant revolts and nationalist uprisings, really, that were the result of the economic hardships of the interwar period. There was a complex relationship between nationalist movements and the development of communist parties within Vietnam. But it was by no means a given that the communists in 1945 had the upper hand in the national liberation movement. Japan had tolerated the existence of a Vichy regime in Vietnam. They had used Vietnam as a staging post for invasions of Malaya and Singapore. It was the deep water Cameron Bay was an excellent place for Japan to moor her ships. About 100,000 French colonists stayed on in Vietnam during the war, and they experienced gradually greater privations, but it's really nothing compared to what happens to the ordinary Vietnamese people. Because of the Japanese presence in Vietnam, Vietnam itself becomes a battleground. When Japan's air force is stripped bare due to the various battles in the Pacific and over Burma, the American and bombing of Vietnam during the Second World War begins in earnest. And that bombing, as it eerily did 20 years later, interesting echoes and comparisons there, the bombing profoundly affects the Vietnamese peasants. It destroys roads and bridges, it prevents peasants from getting food to market, destroys farmland, and it results between 1944 in a famine. But it actually served the Vichy regime, the sort of fascist Vichy rulers, to really foster a sense of Vietnamese nationalism and to allow Vietnamese nationalist publications and speakers and writers and intellectuals and all that to be able to speak publicly. Because this was a useful weapon against the Allies. The idea that the bulk of the population might shift towards support for the British and the Americans was a real worry for the Vichy French. And so part of the reason why there was this febrile atmosphere of nationalist tension in 1945 is because the Vichy French had to some extent encouraged it. And obviously Japan's pan-Asianist nationalism that had been part of the kind of the ideological justification for Japan's wars across Asia, again, as it had done in Burma and Malaya and Indonesia, ignites nationalist passions within the Vietnamese population. So this is the kind of thing that the British inherit when they turn up in September 1945. Even after the liberation of Paris in 1944, there's comparatively little shift amongst the French colonists in Vietnam towards a more pro-Allied stance. The Free French have a mission in Calcutta, and agents that parachuted in and out of Vietnam. And they were aware that there was, even after France had been liberated, comparatively little sympathy for shifting away from the Axis. The Japanese had hoped that they would still cling on to parts of their empire, such as Malaya and southern Indochina. And in May 1945, when suddenly the Vichy forces in Vietnam do begin to waver, the Japanese act ruthlessly and imprison them and a great many of the French colonists. At the end of the war, the Japanese, realising it was very difficult with limited resources and overstretched resources to hold on to Vietnam, allow a limited degree of self-rule. So they allow for the Vietnamese in certain parts of the country to form autonomous local governments. They give some power back to the Bao Dai emperor, who had the Vietnamese emperor who had collaborated with them during the war. And he is installed at the ancient city of Hue. Though really there is kind of very little real autonomy. Most powers were retained by the Japanese. But at this time you have a countryside that is very chaotic. There are armed nationalist gangs, communist gangs, different ethnic and tribal peoples across Indochina have declared their authority, their autonomy. There are villages fighting with each other for tracts of land. So you have a kind of a low level of chaos and violence as different parties scramble to see who can determine the fate of post-war Vietnam. The last act, and this was clearly to poison the Europeans' milk, if you will, the last act of the Japanese in August 1945 was to recognise Ho Chi Minh's government in Hanoi. The Chinese were quite happy with this as the Chinese army marches into Hanoi, and they thought that it would be better to deal with an independent Vietnamese government as opposed to a colonial French one. The British themselves didn't have a great deal of knowledge about Indochina. It had featured very little on Britain's imperial radar, and you think, well, I suppose, why would it? Britain had a far larger Asian empire than France, and British knew roughly that there was something kind of slightly mysterious and oriental about Vietnam, but that was about it. They had little understanding of the politics of Vietnamese nationalism. And they had used predominantly Indian and Gurkha soldiers in order to reconquer the country. British generals and administrators in India tended to dismiss the rumours or discussions or talk of the attitudes and outlook of the Vietnamese people. There was a fascinating article written about 20 or 30 years ago now by an American officer, American intelligence officer, who was in Vietnam.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
During the Vietnam War and during the interrogation of a Vietnamese prisoner, the Vietnamese prisoner said to him, "Well, we fought the Chinese for 1,000 years and we fought the French for 100 years. And then we fought the Japanese for 5 years. So if we have to fight you for another 200 or 300 years, that's okay. We'll do that. And we'll win in the end." And it was at that point that the American officer realised that there was going to be no winning of the Vietnam War for the United States. And it was this kind of sentiment that the British were almost completely ignorant of. One of the first British tasks was to release Allied prisoners of war. And then it was to root out and arrest Japanese war criminals and Vichy collaborators. And the problem, again, here, particularly with the Vichy collaborators, is that there were various different gradations of this. There were those who amounted to being war criminals or who were going to be shipped back to France for a firing squad, and various other lower levels of merchants and middlemen and in-betweeners who had been, to some extent, tainted by Vichy and Japanese rule. The British acted as a colonial occupying power, whereas in the north, the Chinese, in part led by the Americans. Certainly they had American officers and generals and advisors were far more inclined to allow the Vietnamese in the north to run their own affairs, and saw that there was a great deal of advantage in allowing them to do so. And the Japanese, when the British arrive, are still really kind of policing Vietnam. They are aware that Japan has surrendered, but they still have a role in, as they see it, in maintaining law and order. And the British are first keen to corral them into one place. They don't want the Japanese wandering around. They are allowed to keep their own officers. They are, because of the British have carefully worded how they take prisoners from the Japanese, so as perhaps to avoid the niceties of the Geneva Convention. If war crimes tribunals need to take place, they refer to the Japanese soldiers as surrendered personnel, not as prisoners of war. So the Japanese have a slightly better status under British occupation than they normally would have done. And the British seem to have a fairly cordial relationship with Count Taruchi, who was the supreme commander of Japanese forces in Indochina. The French colonists, on the other hand, do not react very well at all to Indian and Gurkha troops. And these are the elites of the Indian army turning up and effectively rescuing them. They considered, and from their own sort of parochial and fairly racist world view, they considered that not only had they been humiliated by one Asian power, the Japanese, and they were now being humiliated by their own native upstarts, the Vietnamese, but now a third Asian power had come to rescue them in the guise of the Indian army. Gracie himself has some curious views, curiously contradictory views on the subject of race and bigotry. He absolutely despised any intolerance towards his own Indian men, and said that they should not be referred to as blacks, which obviously implied that he thought that to refer to somebody as black suggested they were African, which was, you know, a bad thing. Whereas his Indian soldiers were as fine as anybody else. But then he thinks that the French colonists should be protected, and these are really the kind of the rightful rulers of Vietnam, and the idea that you turn the country over to the native population is quite an anathema. So it is a very complex and compartmentalised view of race and ethnicity, and one which is quite contradictory. The Japanese, for their part, loathed the Free French and actually quite respected the British. There were British and Japanese officers who would sit and discuss about the battles of Imphal and Kohima with one another. And the Japanese, who had this slightly auxiliary policing role were pleased to inflict all manner of petty rules on the Vichy French, and particularly Vichy French officers. The Vietnamese cheered the British forces marching back into Vietnam. They cheered the British and the flags, banners say, "Welcome to Britain and America," but not the French. They were very concerned that France was planning a recolonisation of Vietnam. The reaction that Gracie has to some of the nationalist groups is excessive, to say the least. The Viet Minh, the nationalist Viet Minh organisation, began to protest against the possibility of recolonisation with strikes. And Gracie decides that he's going to declare martial law on pain of death, enforced on pain of death, summary execution for wrongdoers. And this applies to all of southern Indochina. This shocks even Mountbatten, who's taken aback by the unnecessary, over-the-top nature of it all. This inflames the Viet Minh, who become angry and they decide to arm themselves and get ready for armed struggle. And Gracie then believes that the Viet Minh are the big problem. He decides, with discussion from the Free French, that a thousand of the French POWs and internees should be armed by the British, and Gracie allows them to stage a coup against the new embryonic Viet Minh government that is trying to form itself in the south. On Sunday the 23rd of September, the French colonists attack. They kill the Vietnamese guards at the Viet Minh People's Committee, and then attack committee members, killing some of them and imprisoning others. The nationalists across Saigon were attacked, and any French who had sympathised with the Viet Minh were ritually humiliated in the streets. This was not done by uniformed soldiers, but by kind of irregulars who then, in a quite kind of grotesquely arrogant display, show their kind of dominance of the Vietnamese. This decision by Gracie really can be seen as the origins of the Vietnam War itself. The response from the Vietnamese is brutal violence against the French colonists. 150 French men, women and children were murdered in Saigon, and then the French colonists attack again. It's not dissimilar in a way to the wars of decolonisation, the violence and brutality and inter-ethnic violence of the wars of decolonisation in Algeria. The breakdown into violence and chaos led to the British, who the 20th Division of the Indian Army wasn't sufficiently large enough to police all of Cochin China and to prevent the violence spreading. And so this is the point at which the British decided to rearm the Japanese and use them as an auxiliary fighting force. Some of the Japanese had sympathies towards the Viet Minh, and the Free French suspected that the Japanese were helping them. This isn't an official policy, particularly on the part of the Japanese, but there was certainly the Japanese were largely obedient to British orders, as those orders filtered through their own commanding officers. However, they seem to have had this visceral loathing of the French. The British make some attempt to negotiate with the Viet Minh, but by New Year 1946, they've been largely driven underground. The left-wing British MP Tom Dryburgh, who was a friend of Mountbatten's, made some attempt through the Communist Party to contact the Viet Minh, but this comes to nothing. And certainly Gracie has no interest in negotiating with the ethnic Vietnamese nationalists, as he has no respect for them whatsoever. In fact, Gracie seems to have excelled in exacerbating the situation and threatening the Viet Minh with a civilian massacre if their activities continue. The British say, well, you know, we have no actual interest in Vietnam, we're just here to keep order. And the Viet Minh turn around and say, well, no, that's not what you're doing. You're here to transition Vietnam back to purely colonial rule. The British hoped that the Americans, who were backing the nationalist Chinese, would clamp down on the Viet Minh in the north. And the response from the Americans is less than enthusiastic. Gracie responds to the unrest from the Viet Minh and from attacks by the Viet Minh on British forces with punitive attacks, burning down Vietnamese villages. But he says that had the French been let loose on the Vietnamese, they would have burnt down, he says, not 20 houses, but 2,000, probably without warning to the inhabitants. Finally, in January 1946, a rather poorly thought through and weak attempt by the Viet Minh to march on Saigon is met with slaughter from the British. Indian and Gurkha soldiers lay waste to them with machine gun fire. This followed the November 1945 handover of Indochina to the French, when the Japanese finally accept, finally sign a surrender declaration and the responsibility really of the British for Indochina comes to an end. Gracie handed Indochina back to General Leclerc, who had been one of the liberating general French liberators of Paris, and he believed that he was doing what was required by international law. He was returning the property of France to the French. And this really shows the kind of some of the colonial attitudes, imperial attitudes, that were prevalent at the time and in subsequent decades. Anyway, I hope you found this a useful and helpful podcast, and we'll be catching up again sometime early next week. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye. Oh, and one final word. Thanks to everybody. We hit the 80,000 subscriber mark today. So thanks for all your support.